Greetings, fellow travelers, and welcome to the Way of the Showman, where we view the world through the lens of showmanship. I am Captain Frodo, and I will be your host and guide along the way. And today, I'm excited to bring you the first of two parts of a conversation that I had with Erik Aubrey in Stockholm, Sweden, at a beautiful gallery there called Den Fantastiska Platsen. Ulla and Sarah's a wonderful little space. It's actually not that little. It's a little bit large, and it's got that means that it gets a little bit of resonance in there, which you will hear in the conversation. And Erik Aubrey has been a long-time collaborator, artistically and intellectually, with Jay Gilligan, who you can hear their podcast. They have a podcast called Object Episodes, and they do some incredible work there. Erik Aubrey is currently writing his doctor's thesis about juggling, or as you will hear, it's much more complicated of how to write something which is related to juggling or whatever. It's very interesting, and we go deep into it. But he's an inventor. He's invented the strange and beautiful kinetic sculptures, ghost cubes. You can find that on the internet. I'll post the link. And he's also an extraordinary juggler. And I'll post some links to some of his work, some beautiful shows that he does together with Jay, where they have developed a beautiful style of how to present almost exclusively non-verbal, incredible skills, incredible invention. So without further ado, I would like to bring you that interview. And before that, just say I'd love to be able to connect to more of you. So if you want to find out what I'm doing or find out what's coming up in the next episode or whatever, which is like next episode will be the second part of this interview. And after that, we will have a conversation with Jay, with Matt King. Matt King is also an extraordinary person, someone who I'd been a fan of for a long time. He's got a permanent show in Vegas and has had so for 20 years. So that's coming up in not the next one, but the episode after that. And that'll be a two-parter as well. But if you want to find out about some of these things, then sign up to my to The Way of the Showman on Instagram. The Way of the Showman on Instagram. When this conversation starts, it's sort of picking up on something that we've already been talking about. Jay Gilligan is doing the sound check, and you hear him snapping and a few things there. And Erik and I are talking briefly about Thales, which is a pre-Socratic philosopher, Thales of Miletus. He's kind of credited with having been the first philosopher that in the Greek tradition. So kind of started off the Greeks there, and it's just brief, but just so that you know, we're just talking about this one philosopher and how he brought in a new way of thinking and a new way of asking questions, just so catching you up. And with that, let's jump into the world of ideas with Erik Aubrey.
What was the question you had then about Thales?
No, I was just, it's such a crazy shift, right? Everybody's looking out in the world and they're like, it's the god of fire, it's the cloud man, it's, you know, we're coming from the stars or whatever. And then comes this idea that, like, hey, let's have a look what's out there and see if we can describe it more, you know, in terms of what we can actually decipher about the world.
Yeah.
It's such a shift.
It's a huge shift.
Yeah.
And I think that's why he is like, this guy Ian McGilchrist that I really like, he really has a bee in his bonnet about Heraclitus, the guy who said it's like you can never step into the same river twice. He's, as far as he's concerned, he's like the forerunner to Henri Bergson and Alfred North Whitehead and process philosophy. Like, he sees a lot of that there, and he sees a lot in him. But with all of those early ones, they don't have so much. It's all fragments and, right, and little bits or whatever. So, and it's not that they think that I don't see it as in that Thales from Milet or whatever, that he had a specific thing that we go, oh yeah, he just solved it. It's more that he has he's asking the questions in a different way, or he's found a new way to ask questions, or so, which I think is the big shift why he is on the map or so.
Mm. And well, I didn't have any other concerns or anything.
No, but just a
broad question.
Because what I have understood from listening to you talking on object episodes is that you're very interested in questions, and that maybe lately you're more interested in questions, in finding good questions, than in actually finding the answers. And I think I'd like to get there, but I find that we just had a conversation with Eva, and he was, through that conversation, we basically arrived at this thing of going, you can't stand at the front of people and just give them the answers unless they have asked those questions, either silently in themselves and want to know them, or they are literally asking them of you. So in that way, it's like you are now at the far end of the learning experience in academic learning, because you're doing a PhD.
That's correct, yeah.
So, and at what is in academic, or like where a university is at, or what learning is at, that is the end stop, like in a way.
In one way, yes, but in another way, it's also the beginning.
Yes, and that was the point I was going to make, because now you've come all this way and you should finally be the one that has the answers, and all you're doing is looking for the beautiful questions.
No, but basically, it's kind of funny that it's, like you're saying, it's the last step of studies, but I mean, also, ironically, I never did a BA or an MA.
Oh, yeah.
No, so I have something like a BA in the past. Yeah, so I guess I could count that. And I did count that in terms of, because I had to have the proper accreditation, of course, to get into the PhD. So I had something that I could equate to a BA, but the MA I didn't have. So there was it was a huge part of the application to kind of fix that. I had to submit 50 references of works, and it was pretty crazy.
50 references of works, what, that you had read or interacted with?
No. My own works.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So let's just take one step a little bit back, because what is your PhD in? Like, what's the field that you're, is it circus? Is it juggling? What is the actual PhD?
So the actual title is very long, and I'm embarrassed to say I might even screw it up, but I'll try. So it's in the first part of this is fine arts. So it's a PhD in fine arts in performative and media-based practices with the specialization of choreography.
Okay.
So that's the entire title. And I'm not actually sure, if I manage to make it in the end, what the diploma actually going to say, because they're restructuring the university.
Ah.
So there's no... So I used to be at the circus department, but there's no circus department anymore. Now there's only two departments, and they've been uncertain about what to call those departments. They might even be called Department 1 and 2 as of now. But they're going to find names for them. But it was something about, at first they wanted to call the one department performance and the other something else. But then, because all the fields in there, or the specializations, is film and media, theater, circus, dance, and opera. Right. And then they're going to take all those specializations and divide into two departments. So, yeah. You can understand that
it's complicated.
Not so easy. So, but as of now, that's what the title is going to be: fine arts, performative and media-based practices, specializing in choreography.
But the reality of it is, I'm like going, what is he writing about? Well, he's writing about circus, or he is writing about juggling, even more specifically. But at least those are your interests. So how? From media-based practices with a focus on choreography, because that is so wide that it feels like you could do kind of anything, but the questions that you are asking under that umbrella, how did you word this to be accepted as a thing to write about?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right that it's really broad, and the reason why it's choreography and not dance or circus is because the dance and circus, that was the first two departments that were clumped together. So it was, as you probably remember, it used to be called DOC, Dance, Dans och Cirkus Högskolan, the University of Dance and Circus. So then they had to find this unifying term for someone who works in either dance or circus.
Yeah.
And that became, oh, there's choreography in both, because you could have that idea to exist in circus and also in dance. So that's why it's choreography. And that's the specialization that I applied to. But as you probably know, I mean, there's this term choreography. I mean, now we have the discussion about that in some kind of extended sense, extended choreography, like, what are we talking about? So it's way bigger than choreographed movement on a stage.
Yeah. You know?
So I think you're absolutely right. It could really mean almost anything, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
But you also have to realize that it's connected to the Bologna Accord, and it's connected to how do we evaluate someone who provides new knowledge to the field.
Yeah.
And that's a whole, you know, that's a huge problem in itself.
Yeah.
And I think the way that that was solved is something like, okay, you have this opportunity with the Bologna Accord to have research in every field, because you didn't have research in the arts before.
Okay.
So, but of course, when that opportunity arises, they're going to take it, right?
Yeah.
But so then how do we evaluate it? It's a huge problem. So it's something like, in my opinion, that doesn't fall on, like, PhD in itself. It actually collapses onto BA and MA as well. Because if you have a faculty with professors that teaches at a BA and MA level, they should be competent enough to understand what a contribution to those fields would be.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. If you have a general understanding enough that you can teach them up to whatever the top level is, if they are to specialize within it, you should have read enough books to see that, oh yeah, this is actually stuff that is not in the books, or it's a synthesis which is so new that it has to count as a new synthesis or whatever.
Yeah. However you come to that conclusion, you have to be in that way. And
at least through a group of them, like a symposium of people, could be able to, it doesn't have to be one person that says yes, but that faculty looks at it, and through their collective knowledge, they go, yes, this is a genuine contribution. Yeah.
So then it's not, if you take that as the base premise, then it's also not unreasonable that that group of people, that faculty, let's say, should be able to read applications about projects that have this as its goal to widen the field, to expand the field, and choose a candidate that they think could be up for the task, right? And you should also, and then you have this, you have the student that's up for that task. It is supported by supervision from the faculty, and then at the end, someone also needs to determine whether you
evaluate it.
Exactly, evaluate. So I think the problem is really a calibration between the selection and the accreditation.
That was a long got lost in politics of that. But so
in terms of my specific project, then,
that's it.
So I applied with a project where I said that I would like to look at the practice of the juggler who also makes the object that is manipulated.
Yeah.
So some kind of intersection between sculpture and juggling was what I proposed. What could such a practice look like? Could we perhaps produce an example of that? Could we then, be transparent in a practice where, you know, such a thing is taken on, and describe that to the best of our ability? Could we, so forth? And that's a little bit the difference between artistic research and being a practicing artist, because if you're a painter, let's say, or a dancer or a juggler, and someone comes and asks, oh, how did you make that?
Oh, yeah.
You don't have to answer that if you don't want to. Maybe you even can't. You don't even have to develop those sensibilities, right? You could yeah, it is what it is, right? This is what it looks like. Go figure.
Yeah, we've been talking about that with Jay, with both with Derek Delgadio and with Michael Motion, where you are listening to, and you're realizing, when you listen to many interviews or so, that there's a mythologization of the creative process, of where certain people that might have seen something from the outside have one thing to say, whilst the person, the story that you tell of how it was created becomes a bit more, it becomes different or whatever, whilst if you are to do creative research in a transparent process, you would have to be fully honest and to keep writing out, if not writing out ahead of time the process that you're going to do, which might also be a case of it, but at least write out the steps that you actually took.
Well, you have to describe a plan in advance, because that's
right.
What you apply for, but you obviously you can't know the outcome.
Yeah, but you set yourself out a path, and then you take whatever whims and turns will come along the way. But then you have to somehow justify or include those into that, at least into the documentation of what it was that you did.
It's up to you what you decide to discuss or document or, you know, deal with in your thesis. And thesis in this case is called the DARP. It's a documented artistic research project.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the DARP could be a thesis like a book,
mm-hmm.
but it could also include artistic works. Like you could make a dance performance, for an example. And then that performance is part of the thesis. But it is not, we don't evaluate the quality of that dance performance. What is evaluated is you're making a claim that is something like, my research does X. And then the committee will look at, is that so?
Yeah, and then so you say, my work on how to create my own juggling equipment and then develop a language with those things, when I follow these steps in the process, it leads to work in this direction. And then they look at the work that you present artistically, and they will see whether that seems to be a logical path that you could create those things. It's
something like that. I mean, I'm midway, so I can't.
No.
I might screw some of
still,
these things up.
Yeah,
but it's something like that. But you have a lot of freedom in terms of what you want to discuss in that practice. And you can also, you know, deal with, you know, the risks that you took in that, or the failures that you took in that, or the strategy that you developed and you talk in order to reach a certain point. And maybe what you're interested in is just that strategy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not so much perhaps about the end result, because it's not a case of trying to make, you know, artistic products.
Yeah. It's not. Yeah. So, yeah, that's right. And it's because it's fine art. All you want to make is a kind of viable roadmap that could potentially produce new work. Whilst if you make a machine, it would need to produce the same thing each time. Or,
well, I don't know if it needs to produce the same thing each time.
No,
and it also doesn't need to end up with an artistic thing, because it is art as method.
Mm.
So it is art, like art making is a method to accomplish something, but that could be anything. If you want to use artistic means to investigate, I mean, I don't know, I don't want to pull a bad example out there, but it could be something that isn't art, you know?
Yeah.
I look at how people, you know, interact in, you know,
patterns of interaction,
something like that, right?
Settings, yeah.
And I use artistic means to investigate that.
Oh, yeah.
Then it is an artistic practice.
So so this, like when you're saying a method, it could be like when we talked to Eva and we talked about a meditational practice, that failing at meditation, like you sit and you try to calm your mind, or you try to and it's almost like somebody a long time ago worked out that if you sit and try and do that, you realize that you can't. And then you just sit with that continuous failing of that and learn how. So in that way, like what you're doing is to make a sort of artistic practice in the terms of not something that is going to lead to a result, but a process that you can go through as an artist. And
yeah, I can't actually say how successful you have to be. Like, could you produce an example of a practice that leads to some kind of failure? I don't know. Maybe you could make that interesting enough that the kind of knowledge that is produced along the way could still be evaluated as having value, even if the result, because I couldn't tell you that.
But it's because if you look at it in a picture of like in circus, you go, if you have a practice that becomes very elaborate and very involved and then ends in failure, that to me is somehow a description of what the clown does a lot of the time. Like, so turns out this is a valuable practice for the clown to go all the way to the very extreme, and you're touching on the sublime, and then it all somehow falls apart, and then the pants fall off, and it's the end of the act.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, then you also perhaps need to define failure in such an instance.
Yeah.
There's this, I thought of it when we were talking to Eva, there's this kind of meta joke that goes something like, a man writes a book with the title How to Be a Complete Failure, and it doesn't sell a single copy. Isn't that then a great success?
Yeah.
Which then would be counter to what the title says, right?
Yeah. So the book has failed because it is a failure itself, which means it succeeded at doing the thing. And now that's like Gödel's criticism of mathematics as well, like and this thing that I like the statement I always lie. That's also a thing that implodes on itself, because if I always lie, then I lied now, which means that sometimes I tell the truth. So it's that same kind of recursive loop of of a book that's a failure that actually succeeded in its thing, possibly better than it would than if so.
Yeah, but to tie back to where I was describing the project that applied with. So I applied with that project, the juggler and the sculpture, some kind of meeting there, and like, what's that practice? What I wasn't informed about when I started actually was that you can kind of switch along the way if you want to. I thought that this project that I applied with, you actually had to realize it, but you don't need to do that. Although I don't know if anybody, you know, kind of switches on the spot. As soon as they're inside the door, they're like, I'm going to do this. I don't know if such a thing has happened. I do think that most people, they start with what they applied with.
And they are actually interested in pursuing that question.
Yeah. But, I mean, if you think about it, it makes perfect sense that you have to be able to change along the way, because you can't possibly know what a five-year process, what kind of questions you're going to have at the end. And you don't want to waste that chance of actually discovering something that's more interesting than what you thought in the beginning.
Yeah, and also you would, if it genuinely is true that you are seeking out something new and you're walking down that path, then you don't quite know what it is that you're going to find. You're not just sketching out something that you've already worked out. You're genuinely looking into it. So you might find new avenues and new ways to explore it that you didn't think of before it started. So it makes sense.
Yeah.
But have you refined your search, or like?
So the way that the research is structured is that you have seminars along the way. You have a 30% seminar at 30%.
Yeah, I saw that.
50% seminar.
Yeah.
You have 80% seminar, and then you have a final seminar, and then you do some stuff in the end. So,
just unpack that a little bit. What it actually means, like, what did you do in your 30% seminar, for instance? What was the goal? And since I kind of watched that, so I could have something to ask about there.
Yeah. So in my case, I already had some kind of a case study of a juggler who works creating objects in a studio and with tools and materials and such. So I had a practice like that already when I began, but I had never tried to, you know, explain that practice or reflect on it or, you know, it was more of a, like, you know how you work kind of intuitively and you kind of do things and maybe you have an idea and then you do something else. And then afterwards you might kind of post, how do you say?
Retrofit.
Yeah, exactly. And be like, oh, I did that because this. But, and I'm happy to do that. I think that there might be more truth to that than what it feels like when you conjure it up.
Yeah.
But I do think that, yeah, we do that, definitely.
Yeah, I mean...
Post-rationalize.
Yeah. And it is also, this process genuinely is a mystery, which is why you can do a PhD in it too. It is not a straightforward thing. And just like when you sit quiet and you try to do nothing, ideas and thoughts and stuff just bubble up in your head when you're trying not to. Random stuff, before you know it, you're thinking about a place that you used to live when you were a teenager and somebody who lived down the street. And you were sitting quietly as a 40-year-old man on the floor trying to think of nothing. And you didn't notice, and all of a sudden you're like, far down this road, so it bubbles up. So of course, within what you're doing too, like this, it's going to be ideas pop up when you're not working. This is part of what creativity kind of is. It's like you delve deeply into it and you read a whole bunch and all that, and then you let go, and then connections are being made in your mind. And some of that is like, it's unclear how you made that connection, but then when you later on post-rationalize it, you're making sense of the thing. So into which degree can you then, anyway, that is the question, isn't it? Like, so how do you then, the post-rationalizing, like it is just, you're looking at the process of how you arrived at your early things before you started to...
I think it's something like, okay, I did, you know, I had the activity that I had, how can such an idea emerge? And then you have to look at, okay, well, what was I doing? What was I reading? Who was I talking to? And then you realize, like, oh yeah, you know, I was collaborating with this person and they talk a lot about, you know, X. So I may, even if I can't, you know, draw a straight line from that conversation into what I was actually doing, I could still describe kind of the earth, the soil of where these ideas grew. And like, for an example, me, I was deeply immersed in circus history and juggling history and the, you know, the thin literature that exists in the field of juggling. Like, I had gone through that and I had a lot of, you know, I had a lot of ideas about that, and I had a lot of, you know, you develop something like a relationship to something. If you've done something for a long time, and then suddenly you find out, like, for an example, why the object that you've used for, you know, hours and hours every day, and that's been in your hand a million times, now you suddenly find out why it looks the way it looks, and how it was made, and why, and all these things, right? That can have pretty profound realizations to what it is that you're doing. So I tried to describe things like that, and I also tried to describe some kind of meeting between the history of juggling and also like just practices of art and architecture. Like for example, I tried to express the link between juggling tricks that we I mean, you're a juggler yourself. You know, for an example, if you juggle a three-ball cascade, and let's say it's three throws for now, you can throw one throw over the shoulder, the other one under the leg, and the third one behind your neck, let's say, and then you repeat that cycle. And that's a way of working that jugglers are... it's like ingrained in juggling culture now. It hasn't been for that long, but I think it's a very common way of working, is to like break down what you do into components and see how you can kind of mess around with those components.
Yeah.
So I was looking at that, and I was looking at that in terms of geometric shapes. Like, how can I take components that are geometrical and like mess around with them in structurally? And what kind of results appear then? And like, what is that like in terms of a sculptor doing that? and kind of relationships like that, I thought was that was interesting for me.
So just like, so I of course think of your ghost cubes, that is like an example of these things that look like dices, like die, and then they are connected on certain parts. So you're making a sculpture which can be moved in sequences, which would make a sculpture behave in time, whilst most sculptures are just related to space, as I would kind of think it is. It's standing still, and that's the traditional sculpture. There are mobile sculptures, but still. And you are making sculptural, and you used the word architectural, but they're basically like shapes that fit in space that can somehow be manipulated. Is that correct? Like that there needs to be moving parts and stuff that you can then make a sequence out of, like the behind the neck, under the leg, and...
Yeah, there was actually an architectural reference there that I was coming to, and that is an Italian architect called Enzo Mari. And he made very expensive furniture, and he had this idea that why should design only be available to rich people? Like, designed furniture should be available to everybody. Mm-hmm. So sometime in the 70s, 74, I believe, he made a collection called, he made a booklet called Autoprogettazione. And the booklet is a furniture collection, and it's all based on the same plank of wood. So the idea is that you can go to the lumber yard and you can just buy these different lengths of wood, and you say, I want 10, you know, stumps this long, 8 this long, 5 this long, and you could bring those home and just nail and a hammer, and you make these furniture in your home. And this little booklet describes this. So the components are the same, you could say. The material is the same. The width of this plank is the same. And I always just thought that it was an interesting reference in terms of what I was doing and in terms of juggling, to kind of show that similar ideas exist in all these fields. And like, if we can point out those similarities and be like, look, this is actually the same as juggling in this way. You have a component, you mess around with the component, and different variations will appear, right? And then you get these kind of triangulations, for example, between juggling and architecture and, you know, history of juggling, let's say, because we have a crafts practice there that normally doesn't exist in juggling.
Yeah. So it's comparing two things like juggling and architecture, and then you're anchoring that in through some sort of historical examples or something.
Well, the way I see it is like I try to describe the growing, the kind of the thought space where the idea appeared.
Mm.
And you could say, well, I had this specific book, here's what that's a reference. Then we have juggling history, that's another reference. If you back up in time far enough, you'll reach a time where jugglers couldn't go to a store and buy the objects. And not only couldn't they buy the object, there also wasn't a standardized list of objects that all jugglers used. Like today, we have balls, clubs, rings, Diablo, devil stick, and so forth, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you back up far enough, it's just like any object, basically, out of the everyday life
that
could be used. So it's just different types of reflections. Like, okay, I could look at that, and I compare that to life of a juggler today, and I see certain differences. I can compare it to the architecture and this work of Enzo Mari, and I could see, okay, it's this work with a component that is repeated and mirrored, etc., right?
Mm.
And in my case, I also looked at origami, because you had this paper folding idea and a box of paper that, because the very first cube configuration that I used, I did not invent the structure.
Oh, okay.
It was something that I had seen on YouTube, 9 boxes in a two-dimensional pattern, but it was very small. It was like 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters.
Okay.
And I thought, okay, that would be interesting to have kind of in a juggler's size, and made out of wood, like big. And then there was one or two other shapes, other structures like that used cubes. and the conclusion then was, and again, referencing juggling, we know that when you have the possibility of variation, it's not going to be three variations. Mm. It's going to be a million variations, right? Yeah. So I intuitively knew that immediately when I had three or four or whatever it was. So it's just like, okay, there's going to be a plethora of possibilities here. I just need to find a way to research the structure so that this plethora of possibilities, variations could be uncovered, just like it is in juggling, just like it is in furniture making, let's say.
Or skateboards.
Same thing there.
Simple structure with endless possibilities, or within magic in a deck of cards, where you sort of, I sometimes think that a skateboard is like a deck of cards in that it's so simple in a way, even though the thing is complex in itself, it becomes one unit that opens up a incredible realm of possibilities or whatever, and you would pull it from the specific planks cut in a certain way and a whole catalogue of possible furniture that could be made from that.
Yeah.
You make some limited choice, and then the recombinations of this can become as different, like all of them are furniture, it's like a chair and a bed and a
table.
Bookshelf or a table, yeah. And yeah. So yeah, I can see how you can say they're two different things. And how that then is connected with juggling history, looking for examples and stuff in history.
Yeah, I mean, just for a second, we're not going to spend too much time on artistic research, but just for a second to explain that then, because now in our conversation now, we had, you know, many references, origami, magic, skateboarding you brought up.
Yeah.
So one, I think, important thing there is, which of these references do you choose to describe this process succinctly? Maybe you don't need all 10 of them. Maybe you choose, okay, but for
probably
me, the
not,
most central thing, the most central thing was origami, juggling history, and, you know, architecture or something.
Yeah. I mean, because that's the thing. If you want to write exhaustively about something, you need to limit it very much. Because every time, well, there's that, I think of as like almost like a, that two is also three. Like you have one and then you have the other, but you also have the relationship between those. And just when there's just two, there's still then the singular two individuals, and then there is the two of them as a unit or whatever. So every time you add in another, well, it's also like skateboarding, then now just that's going to be another huge process to try to get your head around to encompass, roll that in. So
right.
It's good to keep it small if you're going to write something about it. But I do know from my own writing, which is no one is posing any limitations in that. And then it's sometimes very nice to be able to just say, oh, and it's like this, and it's like that, and it's like this. And you're going, yeah, but when you fully combine these two things, like I have an ongoing thing about that will be maybe the season 5 of my podcast of the act as an organism.
Yeah.
What does it mean to be an organism, and in how many deep ways is to create an act, or what a performer does on stage, how closely they interlink with each other, that's become like the thing, even though I have other analogies of what an act can kind of be, but looking at it from biology point of view, I see they behave like two very similar phenomena, so whatever. But
right.
That's beside the point.
Yeah, no, but I think that's somewhere around there, that's what my 30% seminar was about.
Yeah.
I had this specific case study of the ghost cube, how that was made, which references do I choose to most effectively describe that process, and also my state of mind, what made these ideas emerge. For me, it was so easy to see that there was a million possibilities. It was so easy to see. Even if these cube structures that moved, they had the earliest reference that I have, I think, somewhere in the 60s or 70s. So they had been around for a long time, but they were stuck at three or four, you know? And then I could come around and immediately, you know, a million.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that was interesting, that was such an easy step for me to take because I come from the place that I come from.
Yeah,
and that gives a certain value, I think, to describe that and what skateboarding is like, what juggling is like, how we think. as jugglers. Maybe it's easier to see there.
Could be. But so that was like, that's the first step of the way, and then you're having that seminar, and who attends those seminars? Are those the people who would later on, is it called adjudicate, or they like will judge your thesis, or so they will see how far you are along the way, and your guide along the way, or whatever they're called?
Yeah, I think the seminars, they have a number of purposes. First of all, they're there to be some kind of easing into a public defense.
Do
in the end, so you kind of practice there.
Already seeing if your case is holding water after
30%. Practicing, discussing what you're doing, etc. And because it might be a bit brutal to be like going to your own lab for 5 years and then come out into the sunshine and now you have to defend what you're doing. So I think that helps
you not getting lost along the way, like doing a preview showing of your work or testing out the stuff. I was doing the paddle move kind of stuff here now, and it's doing some magic. And I showed it to some people when I was in Greece and people were loving it. And I'm like feeling this is not actually a routine. It's just a sequence of stuff.
Yeah.
And then I showed it to Sindri, and Jay saw it. And it was it's awesome. And I showed it today to Eva, and he was like walking around, kicking the wall. So it was like, oh, there's something here. And it's great. So now I like this proof of concept that I should continue to work on it, because I hadn't locked anything down because I didn't know whether it was
worthwhile. See it later.
Yeah.
No, but you also practice, you know, to communicate, I think, in those situations. Like this stuff, if I describe this process and like people don't understand it at all, then I obviously have to think it through a little bit more.
I mean, because it is always abstract when you're taking two things and you put them next to each other. Because just like with a metaphor, like a good metaphor is the same as, but it is also different. And somehow in that, like, because they're not the same, because they're only the same if they are the very same thing. And then we can go, like, even two bottles of Ramlösa that are standing here. They're not even the same thing, even though they're identical somehow. So, like, you're putting them on top. They are also different. So when you say a catalogue of planks cut in a certain way that can become furniture, that's just like juggling. It took me a little while there to sort of go, oh, in which way is the... Because you're talking about
structures of the same component.
Yeah, different structures of the same component. So the three balls can become an endless exploration of possibilities.
Just like a plank.
Just like the plank. But it took me a little while to get to that. So like, what did you do specifically in your talk, though, to make that clear for people? Or did you like have stuff that you showed? Did you pick up the balls and juggle them? And did you like have some blanks and make a bed?
I did pick up the balls at one point specifically, because some of the work that I developed in juggling is what a juggler calls a head roll.
Yeah.
When you roll a ball from temple to temple. And that was my exploration in terms of finding a million variations. I made patterns with that technique baked into three ball placements and throws. So you can imagine you have three balls and one ball is now on your temple.
Yeah.
So you tilt your head to the side and then you roll the ball over to the other temple and then you switch it for one of the balls that's in your hand.
Yeah, so you're doing like, instead of like three balls is... In a way, it's one ball in each hand and one ball in the air. And before it lands in the left hand, you throw the left hand up so there's only one ball in the air. But that now is sitting next to one of your ears instead. And
yeah.
It rolls on the other side. Yeah.
So this was a very, like, this was kind of the practice example of me exploring millions of variations of that.
Yeah.
So I had that, and I wanted to show to the audience there how easy it was for me to see that, oh, now with the cubes, there's going to be a million variations too. And the reason why I understand that immediately is because of this work.
Yeah. And it's because you are, through your work as a juggler, first through a N plus one toss juggling man who throws and catches more ball or whatever, and then through your specific engagement with head rolls, which was, as far as I knew, a relatively unexplored thing where I thought that was like, oh yeah, you roll it back and forth, that's that, and then you do the next thing. So you're taking an unmined point of juggling and exploring it. So that, that all of that meant that you have some underlying ability to see a pattern that most people then don't see. You see the fundamentals of a trick, and that if these conditions are met, then there are multiple, potentially endless possibilities. So, so you're like making a case for that, and also arguing that this is the case, that one can see this kind of parallel, but also is it also to how for people to discover these kinds of patterns or so?
I mean, I did it specifically to show the link between juggling and sculpture, and specifically a sculpture practice where something is being created using components, and I wanted to illustrate that link.
But not so much as in how to find links like that in the world. It was the practice is not to discover how multiple things can be exploded.
I didn't press on that specifically. Of course, you can come to that conclusion, like, yeah, this could be a strategy that anybody could use as kind of put on those goggles and look at the world, right? Sure, there was that idea, but I wanted to describe my case specifically.
Yeah. You found a specific case that's relevant to you. I'm thinking of this because I just was writing a bit about metaphor and whatever, about my own. I think my own strategy to discover these things is, I think of metaphor a lot. It's like seeing two things that are not the same, but there is something about them that is the same, and the differences is telling you a whole lot of new information. And as I was doing that, I just came across this quote from Aristotle saying that there's like the greatest wisdom or so is found through metaphor. That's the deepest kind of thing. And this is the kind of where you find wisdom and genius in these kind of things. But how to for people to find living powerful metaphors, this is impossible to teach. So I saw that kind of thing and I kind of went, ah, really? And then I know Aristotle said that, but I'm going to try to shape my idea of how you discover those things anyway. But it's very similar now, and I see links anyway with that.
I think it's something like, how do we abstract out ideas from concrete activities or things we see in the world? And that might not be so easy, right?
No.
If I say like, oh, here's a sculpture and it moves like this, and it's just I've been repeating these, you know, base components, and then people go, oh yeah, I don't see that. But if I give, you know, three or four examples where the common link is variations in the structure of components, maybe then that In that series of exhibitions, maybe that idea can be abstracted out and people can understand it.
That's it. So you're giving many different examples, allows them to see the commonality between many, which are also unrelated, but when you make just two things, maybe the thing which is the same is harder to discover, but when there's skateboarding and a deck of cards and all that, and if you have some, at least, understanding of each of those, like the way a deck of cards is used for magic and the way a skateboard is used for tricks and the sculpture and the planks, then maybe you will more easily see the link, even though they're all also extremely different, but there's still some fundamental principles that are... It's almost as difficult to get to, I'm thinking now, as in, although all trees are different, you can immediately look at it and go, it's a tree. What is it that it's the problem of the one and the many in philosophy of like, everything is all totally different and they're going, but still, you can immediately tell it's not just a tree, you can tell which tree it is, even though it's all filled with endless variations and stuff.
Absolutely, yeah. No, so it was along those lines that, you know, you can't, of course, talk and show forever, but I had to pick out a couple of things from that process that I thought, like, okay, these are kind of key things in my practice. And let's describe those. So that was very much what that seminar that you've seen it on video.
Yeah. Well, I saw it when.
Oh, you saw it live?
Okay. Live feed or whatever.
Oh, fantastic! Yeah, maybe I should. I have that video, that seminar on video. I should probably put it out as a hidden link or something.
Yeah. It would be valuable to see because it's, of course, it's like. It is such a deep kind of thing because it can be confusing, I think, when we're going into so much detail about what you actually did in that meeting, and then we might have to sort of zoom back out again and look at, because then of course your process went on and you have, where are you at now? Are you at the 50% or are you at the 80%?
So yet? Now I'm going to do my 50% seminar, and I actually postponed it. I was supposed to have it now in May, but I postponed it to the fall, so it'll be in October probably.
Yeah.
So that's where I'm at now, and I had a pretty good, like, you know, I came to some kind of a conclusion on this practice sculpture juggler thing, but there's so much that happens when you suddenly, because as a working artist you don't really have time to reflect and do those things. So since I'm now doing this full time and you're doing it with other people around you that are also doing this, there's so much that's uncovered that I didn't anticipate in advance. Like, I never really, in terms of, like, if I'm going to describe what's my practice, I don't know if you ever did that for yourself, like, what's your practice? And then you realize that, no, we're actually talking about practices, you know, there's many
absolutely.
Of them. And I don't think I really saw all the activities that I have as artistic practices that generate or contribute to, you know, art making. And that was a bit unclear to me. So there was a lot of kind of like, oh, realizations like that. Like, oh, actually, you know, I've been working with circus archives for 15 years. In my, like, prior to the PhD, I saw that work as not as an artistic practice, but I saw that as just a source. And if I wanted, I could lift something, like, for example, juggling history. I could lift that out of the archive and use that idea, and then it became artistic.
Mm-hmm.
But now I see that whole practice of just messing around and digging and reading, that is a practice in itself.
And this, you talked about that on one of the episodes as well, and this has really helped me shift my idea of what I do too. Because to me, I think of myself, oh, I'm doing some writing and I'm reading some books and stuff, but some people call that studying and they call themselves an author and you are doing some research into, and I totally am. I'm connecting stuff that I don't know of anyone else who connects showmanship to play, or biologically where that came from and how the process of juvenilization where the behaviors of children or the features of children retains itself in when you become adults. Like, nobody else I know of are putting this into a kind of performance context, but I always just think of it as something I'm doing on the side, and I've almost felt like I've always been downplaying it a little bit. And then during the pandemic I made a podcast and realized that there is an audience for people who find some value in these things that I just think of as a bit weird or whatever. And then I meet you who through that comment also goes, it validates this as an artistic practice, because I said it, maybe I said it on the interview with Matt King. I had recently heard that podcast with you, and I said, the weird thing is now that at the moment I'm much more driven towards this writing and exploration of these ideas to create this philosophical foundation for what it is that we do than I am in exploring straight up acts that I'm going to do on stage or the development of shows. So that's my art, where my focus of my art is at the moment, and I'm just doing the same acts in slightly different versions, whether I'm doing it here or there or the next place.
Yeah, I mean, what you're saying now, that's exactly pretty much my realization too. It was very similar to what you
said. I got it from yours, from you. So I heard you say it and I go, that's what's going on. Because I'm also feeling like, oh, I really should spend more time working on these acts. Because I have vague ideas, like you do when you have acts, and I go, I should sit down and just really explore and nail some of those down. But then when I heard you, it somehow gave me this like, oh, I am doing an artistic process, and it's just not specifically going towards putting stuff on stage. But in one way or another, I know that all the work that I do ends up in the show. The things I think, the things I read, and the skills that I learn. I'm doing a paddle move, I'm doing a paddle thing as one of the latest things that I've sort of been playing with. And I don't know where it's going to go, but I didn't know where it was going to go when I started balancing that spoon. And that's become one of my main acts now. Like I have a 5.5 minute act of that. So
totally. And also there's so much that happens when you start looking at your kind of artistic life like that. Because first of all, like it becomes almost like a geography in front of you. Like, okay, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, I'm doing this. And you start to, like you become that guy in the shed. Well, what's that movie, Beautiful Mind? You
know, the strings and that,
You become that guy, right? Yeah, with your practices. Oh yeah, I'm reading that. And you start to see all these connections. Yeah. So it really enriched so much of what I do. Even if I did all those things before, it was almost like one veil dropped from in front of me. And I think it also really uncovers relationships to other people, because then you become really interested in like, oh, what are you reading and what are you doing and what are you like, how do you read? How do you scribble on the paper, how do you, and then you begin, all of this stuff becomes so interesting.
Yeah,
and you can just nerd down to, you know, what kind of pen do you use?
You know,
like suddenly everything matters. Right. Oh, you have special pens?
I have special pens that I use, and I have the type of marker, because I read any book with an highlighter and a pen. And the pen needs to be super fine so I can write in detail in the margins of all of it.
And because it's in the margin, then it's, you know, that uncovers something.
Yeah.
And like pictures suddenly appear. And it's just fascinating.
It's so fascinating. Because all of those things help then expand to, and I'm really interested in depth. That depth as a concept. And depth to me has to do with context. Mm-hmm. How things are related to other things. It's relation. So much of it is that. I'm constantly exploring a deep relationship to my craft, a deep relationship to my art, a deep relationship to people and the world and everything. And that means I'm just looking for how all these things are connected. And that's how I've ended up with basically like a looking for an ontology of what the relationship between an audience and that is, and how I've ended up with that, what I feel like is this dialogic structure, and how I now see how that means that if you have the consequences, and I'm saying this leading towards, because a book is also in my scheme a show. It's a kind of showing. There's just been a delay. Like I do the show and they're immediately watching it and taking it in, and then that's the show creation between the audience and me. But the author is writing something with the intent that it will be read by someone, and in the reading of that, images will come up and they will engage themselves into it. And until it's being read, it almost doesn't exist. It's lying there, but it's only becoming the art through the. So in creating the book, I then go, oh, an author is also in this, following this pattern. I'm also related to an author in what they do. And then that explains why I can also be doing writing.
Totally.
And he said that you'd had some similar idea about like how a book is also, or like what was your take on that thing?
Well, first I'll say, I think what a lot of the stuff that you're talking about now, I think it has to do with precision.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you're just, when you look at your activities singularly, like, oh, I'm a juggler, so I juggle.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, let's say you talk to someone and you're like, how do you do that? Or how was that created? Well, I did it like this, you know.
Mm.
It becomes this very singular thing.
Yeah.
But in order to have precision and really get down to, like you're saying, the depth of something, you really need all these perspectives.
Yes.
You really know, you know, I think like this, I write it down with this pen, it ends up in the margin, this picture appears, it makes me think like this, it makes it possible for me to go back to the notes because I did X and now I can, you see where I'm going?
Exactly, like, yeah.
It's just, all these nuances suddenly appear when you do that. So I think it has to do with precision.
Yeah, and it's also this thing that I'm becoming more and more convinced there is no thing. It's always connected. It's always connected to something else. And when you go, so how do you do this? Oh yeah, I threw it behind my shoulder. And that when we're talking about the frustration of you meeting a first year student and all they're wondering is like, sometimes it comes, it's like I'm going, okay, and then when you've done this move, then you go, hey, like that. And then if the person goes, yeah, hang on, show me, how was those fingers? Mm-hmm. When I'm doing a hip presentation kind of thing, going, oh, one finger's a little bent, and I'm going, no, it's not how that is bent. It's something bigger, and it's how your face is and how the body, and again, if you don't understand that, then it's like they sometimes are too worried about the little details because they can't see the whole picture yet. And I sometimes find that I get lost because as soon as somebody says something, I go, oh, you know how that thing that you just said, it's a little bit like you know, ants, how they are, and then they're like, whoa, why are we talking about ants? Hang on, no, we would have gone. So I think it can also go too far in that direction when I feel like I see these patterns or whatever. So you gotta be, we're just thinking of the guy in the shed with all of the strings. It's like before you know it, you're that guy that's just standing there shouting at the dog and showing, do you understand? It's all connected.
But what was your question about the book? I didn't quite...
Oh, yeah. So I see the book also as a kind of show in my thing. I can see it. It's not so much of a... It's not a show in a normal kind of sense, but it follows that same process of a person who has something to show or something to share with others that they think is of value and that will enrich them in some way. And then when the reader reads that thing, the space that opens up, the area of interest, is kind of similar to the space that opens up between me and an audience. You need to catch their attention in the beginning. Then you need to introduce some things which will catch fire and keep them interested, and then at some point they're actually into the work of art, and your descriptions of, and then they walk past the tree, will now be a whole tree, and then the cars drove by and it's a wide and there's a rock wall, and those little things, they will become alive in their head, and now there is this new world, this third dimension has opened up.
I think the kind of epiphany that I had maybe 2 years ago or something that I just haven't been able to shake since I had it, was that I realized that anything that we create in terms of shows or sculptures or whatever it is, or write a book or whatever, it only, the existence of those things for other people is only the experience that they have of them. Mm-hmm. So for an example, if I have a text that I want to communicate to you and I have it written on a paper, A4 paper, and I stand in front of you and I read the paper, but it's really boring, mm-hmm. and after halfway of the paper, you fall asleep, right? Mm-hmm. Now, this is an extreme example, but
yeah.
Only half that paper exists for you in your experience of it. And I could never, like, I could never shake that off of me. So now I'm, in terms of what I do, it's always like, okay, well, how are they going to experience this? What is the experience? That is always the question. And like in terms of what you were talking about, the book, the world that appears, if that world doesn't appear, there was none.
No, that's right. It is like Hans-Georg Gadamer talks about this, and John Dewey as well, in The Art as Experience. And Gadamer in, what is this book called? I can't remember that, it doesn't matter, but it's this, it's that the artwork only, it is only an artwork when it's being watched by someone. We're sitting in an art gallery now, and when I'm looking at that picture, and even if I just glance at it, it's not even necessarily an artwork yet, but in that moment when I look at it with the kind of intention that we look at art, when you go, what's going on here, and it captures you, that it just brings into life. And in that way, I don't know, I just made it think of a virus, which is like they argue whether a virus is actually alive because it's just inert, and then it connects with something and then it flourishes up and becomes a pandemic or or gives rise to the mother, what is that called again? It's called the afterbirth. That's in between. So like viruses have done many things, is what's my point there.
Yeah.
A little bit sidetracked. But yeah, and then never mind the virus, but that the artwork only comes alive, and it is only as deep as the experiences that people have had with it. And when that person then writes a review of the thing, now it's more people read about it, and they will think it, and they will might go and see it themselves, and then that thing starts to live. Like Philip Glass talking about how he, when he is doing his new opera, he will always be producing kind of more than one performance at the same time. So this thing is going to open here, and then it's going in Vienna, and then it's going to open in London as well, 6 months later. But it's with a different director and a different orchestra, and it, so it's like he's. From the start, so that it goes so that you have two different interpretations, because that first opera might not be understood, but the second one is already in place, and it is the, we love Shakespeare because there are already 1,000 interpretations of it, or whatever. I mean, there's more reasons than that, but that as long as it's just exists on paper, it doesn't actually exist. But the more times it's been shown, the more real it becomes, because the art is the experience of it, or so on. So
right.
I'd find that to be really linked to what you say of the paper only exists if it half exists.
Yeah, and it was actually also one of the little theories that I developed for the 30% seminar. It was this experiential thing about art, and the comparison that I made was between a performance and a sculpture, since those were the two mediums that I was working with.
Yeah.
So if you imagine like three circles next to each other, but they slightly overlap.
Like Venn diagrams, or
not like a Venn diagram, because they're on a line. So the two outside ones, they
like
don't
a three
touch.
Ring circus kind of.
Exactly,
yeah,
exactly,
yeah.
That.
Yes.
Yeah. So imagine that. And so what I saw was this question of who owns time in an experience of art. So in the one circle is where you, the artist, own the time. So if I perform for you, Frodo, you're sitting at that chair, you're the audience, I come in here with my juggling balls or whatever it is that I'm gonna do, and I go pa-pa-da-pa-da, and then when I'm done, I leave.
Yeah.
You had no say in the time
of the experience.
Of that experience.
Yeah.
It lasted for as long as I decided, right?
Yeah.
And if you missed something, well,
tough luck, yeah.
Tough luck, or whatever, right? If it went on for too long,
yeah,
you know,
it's
tough
I'm
luck
suffering.
For you.
Yeah,
you're
yeah.
suffering, right? So that I saw that on the one hand, and on the other hand, I saw the inverse experience where you, the spectator, own the time, and that is the situation like we're in now. We're in an art gallery,
yeah,
right. So we could go up to that photo over there or that sculpture over there, and we're now the spectators. And we can watch that sculpture for as long as we like, right?
Mm, or as short as we like. That's
or
exactly
as short
right.
as
yeah.
we like. Yeah, right?
So that's, yeah.
So in that sense, the you own time, the spectator. And I thought, okay, that's really a different situation in
yeah.
terms of an art experience. Am I as a spectator owning the time, or is it dictated by the performer, let's
yeah.
say? And then I tried to, why the third circle there that intersects the two, that was
always the third. When there's two, there's always the third.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I tried to imagine some kind of shared space that could have perhaps be like a workshop or a lecture where
yeah.
there's an exchange, right? Where I show you something, perhaps, but you could go, oh, wait a minute, what was that thing with the
yeah.
with where you rolled the ball from temple
master
to temple?
Class or something? Or like even when you were talking today, you said, oh, I was at this seminar, but then we're hanging around afterwards for the real seminar, because when you deliver it, everyone is stiff and you got to say all the correct things, and then afterwards you go, what was that deal? And now, to me, I would think of that thing in the middle. It's like it's a dialogue. It's when you, as the show person, you show something like that, but then if the audience genuinely goes, whoa, 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 like say you did the magic with the paddle and something is appearing and disappearing and somebody goes, I just did an example. I did this, I played the musical saw when I was in, I played in a refugee camp a little while ago, and I did the musical saw, and one guy in the audience, some Palestinian guy, just had his mind just melt and thought, because I'd done some magic first, and then I did the saw, and this guy just got up and came into the space and grabbed the saw and grabbed the bow, and I was like going, oh, this is a bit sort of full on, and it's, we got a large, sharp instrument in our hand, like an instrument as in like an object. And I was like, oh, this is like, what's going on here? And then I realized that he's like going, oh, he just needed to somehow try it. And in any formal performance that I would do normally, this is totally out of bounds. But here we're all sitting on the same level there. It's a very relaxed performance. I'm not speaking properly because the people speak Palestinian, people speak Syrian, and I don't know where everyone comes from. People are from Congo and all this. So this guy comes up, and then for a moment I realize he just wants to try, and then it, and he comes up, and I'm going like talking in English, because when I talk English, then the rest of my gestures and everything falls into place in what it is that I'm saying. And, oh, you want to? And I sit him down, and I make him hold it, and of course he can't get any sound out of it. And then I stand behind him, and I'm squeezing on the saw, and I'm going, it's like this, and I'm, and then he goes, ah, and then finally he clocks on, and now the saw is bent in the right position, but it's way too much tension, and I'm trying to undo it, and I'm going, and then by the end he actually makes a noise out of it. And that to me then is an example of when I certainly had an agenda in what I was, but I was pretty much done by the time I had played that end of that song, and I go whoop with my thing, and there's a bit of an applause. That was the end of that bit. But then he stepped into the space and allowing him to now he owned the time, because now I was needing to wait until he had done enough. And when he had done enough, and as soon as he stood up, I threw some confetti, and that was that moment, and I got the time back. But yeah, maybe that's the sort of, it went from being presented just by me and they just had to listen to, he took over and it was just one person, but then it changed the game completely, maybe.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. Then when you have those three circles in front of you, then you realize like, oh, actually, you know what? I can be in the circle where I as a performer dictate time, but sometimes things happen like that. Mm. And sometimes even techniques are developed based on that idea. I think about the Lazzi in mm-hmm. clowning, yes. for an example, where you repeat something that evoked laughter, yeah. for an example. And there's all kinds of stuff. I mean, even the like Shakespearean theater, right?
Yeah.
You can at any point break into dialogue with the audience, you know?
And they can ask you to, this would blew my mind when I can't remember where I heard this, but they go, to be or not to be, and then at the end of it, everyone's like cheering and going, yeah, do one more time, that was awesome. And then the actor would, on location, do a monologue one more time because they liked it, but they didn't quite grasp it or whatever. And this is, so you had this freedom within the material. But what I thought now, though, because I think in a similar way to you, so these patterns of these three, this three-ring circus of who owns the time, now becomes a tool that I can think of during the performance. Because to me, this is what's valuable with the second season, for me, with the second season of looking at the ontology of what we do, and a whole second season of trying to scratch out what is actually the way of the showman. It's a way to approach what I do. And this is what I think about art and entertainment. And I have all these things, when you put it in one long, big thing, then that to me starts to explain, how do you come up with your acts? And I'm seeing the similarities, even though it's quite different approaches, but I felt like I needed to write all of that, which was about 140 pages of text that I read out over 40 episodes or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why I make the acts the way that I do, so that people often go like, what is going on? Why is this act? Why when I watch your act do I get these kinds of feeling? And I'm going like, well, it's because this stuff is somehow involved. Mm-hmm. But then when people hear it, I think a lot of people who hear what I talk about don't even fully get that from episode 24 until episode 60 or whatever. All of that is like one long thought, because it just seems like here's one idea and here's another idea, and I try always to connect it all together. But when you say this idea here now of the three circles, I immediately go, oh, I just did that in that way, and now from I feel like this is where I find value in what most people think of as abstract things. Mm. It's to be able to see a pattern in something, and often through a simple diagram, you can then, it's now lodged in your head, and it now becomes a tool to use when you're out and actually doing work for real audiences.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I use diagrams and like you try to scribble something out as a complement to your text or your writing, and maybe it's not even clear in your mind. Something like this. Well, I dictate time here, that's certain, and you circle it, and you know, so there's a certain way of how those things appear. And I don't know how deep we want to go into that, but there was a couple of variations of that. I can give you one more.
Yeah.
And that was the interaction of that the audience could have with my work. So since I was interested in sculpture, so I was thinking of it as a development that, okay, either I can make the sculpture and I show them.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of step one. They see the sculpture. So it was I drew an eye there. Yeah, they see the sculpture. The next step is that they interact with the sculpture. So they get to touch the sculpture. Mm-hmm. And the third...
So you draw a hand.
Yeah, I draw a hand, exactly. Mm-hmm. And then the third one was that they also get to make the sculpture.
Oh, wow.
And that was kind of the artistic argument for why I wanted to make that set that you could click together, because it was a third kind of the third dimension of the experience of that artwork.
Yeah, you like one, you're quite detached. It's like the eye is touching it, but that's like the least participatory thing you can do. The next thing is that you're actually touching it and interacting with the kinetic sculpture that you've made. The cubes are moving around and you're going, that's amazing. And then the next one is one more level of participation, because you're now maybe first building the one that you have built, but then you start to explore. If you start to go, I see, if these are open on both these sides, that means it can flip like that, and then I make my own.
You could then convert the activity of juggling into an art experience, right, where you get to watch the juggling, you learn how to juggle, and you create the juggling, and you can see that also as an experience from a perspective of creation, I think. So you can draw many parallels, and this is what I really like to do, is when you can uncover all of these things that we do as artists and see them from different perspectives.
Mm.
And that's actually something that I thought you said very nicely on one of your episodes, this taking that outside perspective of something, that you kind of leave yourself and you look into what you're doing from some kind of outside. And I know, like, I'm a big fan of Sam Harris and listen to those podcasts since forever. And that mindfulness idea, I love thinking about that in terms of art making.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, that's right. That idea that you are seeing yourself, for instance, the one that's most salient to me within that is I learning to see that the emotional state that you have now can also just be turned off. Like, you get very irritated for something, and then through having had a meditative practice of you just recognizing emotions arising and trying to sit there still and try to make an emotion happen, like you get angry and then turn it off again. And it has happened in my life that I have, and I have talked about it before, that it's like, it's a real thing where I get irritated and all of a sudden I realize that I am this, and this is the same as in the meditative practice. And then like a flash, I turn the anger off when I'm having an argument with my wife or whatever. And then it's like, over some completely insignificant thing, and you just go, this is not necessary, and go, boom, and all of a sudden the world just dissipates. So that's it's a powerful thing to be able to see yourself from the outside, and you recognize what's going on, and you go, this does not have to be like this, and then it just actually dissipates.
And it's very similar to that shifting of mindset in terms of your activities as an artist. Like, I always saw juggling as an artistic activity, but I didn't see archive.
Yeah, yeah.
One. And then you shift, once you made that perspective shift once,
yeah,
it becomes easier to do that with everything that you do. So if you have the energy for one more example, I can do one.
Yeah, let's do one more example, absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, and leaving you on that cliffhanger there, what will the next example be? Well, you have to smear yourself with patience, as we say in Norway, and we'll pick that right back up again in the next exciting episode of The Way of the Showman. Exciting to talk to a guy of such a prodigious intellect as Erik Aabøri. And finally, before finishing off this episode, I'd just like to say thanks to those people who have recently been buying some of our awesome merch. There's singlets and hoodies and t-shirts, and it's so nice. It's so nice that you guys choose to support the podcast. It's also very nice to see those times when people send pictures and of themselves wearing these things. It's just so great to know that there are people walking about there with the sweet little triangle eye logo that we have of the circus with the eye of all-seeing wisdom on it, walking around with that on their back or on their chest. Thanks a lot, guys. And you can find a link to where to buy those in the show notes. And if you want to just support me without getting any kind of merch, you can buy me some digital coffees. And thanks to Haggis McLeod for buying me 10 coffees just the other day. It is so wonderful, those when it comes through. Not specifically so much only for the money, but just for the fact that somebody went through all that effort. And I know it is an effort. But anyway, it's been a pleasure sharing this leg of the journey with you, and it was a pleasure to talk to Erik Aabøri, and next episode we will be back with more for that. So until then, take care of yourself and those you love, and I hope to see you along the way.